This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
And let's go over to another case that's going on right now in trial. Lindsay Clancy's trial opened in Plymouth Superior Court on the argument that she was so deep in postpartum psychosis and so badly over-medicated that she cannot be held criminally responsible for the deaths of Cora Dawson and Callan, her three children. Prosecutors conceded that she had mental health problems, but told jurors she was not in the throes of psychosis. That after 4 months of treatment, she didn't fully commit to it. She made deliberate choices, so it's all her fault. We've now seen opening statements from both sides. Patrick Clancy has been on the stand as of our recording of this. Her ex-husband testifying that hours before the children died, she was outside building a snowman with them. She was having one of her best days, he said. Prosecutors put photos of a woman functioning normally in front of a jury. Everybody hears that and decides the argument is over, or at least a lot of people do. Doesn't a good afternoon fit psychosis rather than rule it out? And isn't the state's entire opening built on jurors not knowing that? Siobhan Scott is with a psychotherapist and author to help break all this down. I think the biggest battle here seems to be people's understanding of psychosis. It's not someone necessarily sitting in the corner, rocking and shaking and hitting their head against a wall. Although allegedly she was doing that, according to her parents as well. Yeah. It certainly can be that, but can also be building a snowman with your kids before you kill them. Can it?
Yeah. Because you really, you know, observing this external behavior, you don't know what was going on internally. And some people, when psychotic, can understand that they are trying to play normal. They want to be normal, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that they're not in truly inside having delusional thinking going on. And we see that all the time with folks who have a lot of delusional thinking and, you know, meets the criteria for psychosis. I've seen practicing MDs who had psychotic thinking and delusional thinking, but they were still practicing medicine, mm-hmm. you know, and doing a reasonably competent job until they weren't at some point. But, you know, so far, this is going to be a long trial. I've got 6 pages of notes just from the first day. And I am so eager to hear from the people who were providing treatment and what their diagnosis was in the beginning and then how it progressed and how that timeline connects with the symptoms that she was having. Because, you know, looking at my notes, there were just pivot points where, you know, it looked like initially it was postpartum anxiety and depression. And they were giving medications for that, you know, did not look completely unreasonable until just a couple weeks after starting the Zoloft, she was getting worse. Mm-hmm. And there were definitely distinct points where they were layering on the benzodiazepines. They were trying to treat the anxiety. I mean, I can look at the list of meds that, you know, we've been seeing so far, and I don't know how thorough and complete that is. But from the Zoloft and then a couple weeks later, unable to sleep, Ativan and Benadryl, why weren't we looking? Could the Zoloft be activating a bipolar condition, activating a mania there? And that did not appear to be looked at. Now, when we get into adding trazodone, another thing that they add for sleep, it's an old antidepressant, causes drowsiness. So why wasn't, that was November 16th, why wasn't reassessing the diagnosis looked at then? Is this indicated in somebody's treatment notes that they were still looking at anxiety and depression? They weren't looking at psychosis. That's a treatment failure. Escalating symptoms, the end of November, they added more antidepressant. They added Prozac. They were treating symptoms at that point, trying another SSRI, which can also cause manic symptoms to escalate, bipolar symptoms, psychotic symptoms, throwing on Ambien for sleep, Remeron, which is sedating for sleep, Klonopin, another benzodiazepine. So they were trying to calm them down, but they weren't looking at what they needed to be considering. They weren't getting a good differential diagnosis. Late December, they bumped it up to Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic. Okay, What was the justification for that? Because clearly somebody was thinking psychosis at that point. Which provider was it? What did they say in their notes? But she didn't have a good response to the Seroquel. She was getting worse. So at that point, why wasn't hospitalization being looked at sooner? Because again, you look at the whole picture. This is a woman responsible for three little kids. You don't want her in a psychotic state. So where were the gaps? Where were the treatment failures? At some point when she was at McLean Psychiatric Hospital, medication changes again. What diagnosis were they actually treating? And it wasn't until later that they added, okay, it was in early January, they added lamotrigine, also called Lamictal. Lamotrigine is the generic name. That is a specific medication for bipolar disorder. What was the dosage? How was that being monitored? And so we just still, with what was going on clinically, there's so much information missing. And that's the data that I'm really interested in seeing here. Because again, with effective treatment, if she had been hospitalized for 30 days, I don't think these murders would have happened, but its diagnosis is ever evolving. It's difficult when you just see somebody for one visit, you get a snapshot. That first visit, you have to give some kind of diagnosis, right? But it's provisional. You don't know enough. You're not speaking with the family. What are they seeing? And what was she saying? You know, we've talked about these visits were very brief. Were they monitoring? Were they tracking really her thinking process? Were they asking the right questions to get into? You can't just say client is depressed, client is anxious. You have to say, as evidenced by, when I'm doing work with people, I quote them. I quote them throughout the session because I want to know, what are they saying? What are they thinking? I can ask more questions about, okay, you're feeling sad. Tell me more about that. What are you sad about? You know, were they going to that depth? Were they really paying attention to this? Because as you said, this is such a rare condition. They don't see it. Some of them may have never seen postpartum psychosis before. Yeah. So they weren't thinking bipolar 1 disorder. But the other thoughts that came to me, which would fit a lot with what we know so far, would be what's called a mixed episode. And this is a very scary thing, and it's hell for people to experience. A mixed state means you're having severe depression along with the mania at the same time. And it's like your nervous system is like a car where the brake is being slammed on. That's the depressed piece. And then you've got the accelerator being slammed at the same time. So it's incredibly uncomfortable. The symptoms: depression, anxiety, racing thoughts, severe insomnia, agitation with delusions and hallucinations. And that's a very serious thing. And, you know, just from what we know now, I could be completely off on this, but it looks like she was having a mixed state. And the clinicians, at least early on, some of them were confused about that. They weren't recognizing it.
It's incredibly complex, Siobhan. Wow. Thank you so much for that. Bringing the science behind what's going on really helps explain what I'm seeing in the courtroom. And so here's my challenge for people that are on the side of the prosecution that says she had intent, she wanted to kill her kids, that's it. Watch the courtroom, and then I want you to sit there. Just observe, and you can even turn the sound off. And when you just watch her with her lawyer, and when you hear Siobhan go through the chaos of medications and what was going on, and even Patrick this morning testified that he was never told, they were never told to remove the kids from her. She also testified that she never said she had stated that she was going to do harm to these kids. And then I want you, as you're watching her completely collapse, watching the people around her, watching her attorney hold her hand as she is completely collapsed. I've never seen anyone collapse in a courtroom like this before. I want you then go and pull up videos on YouTube and watch people like Corey Richens, Lori de Belvallo. You pick it. You pick any of these, Brian Koberger, who killed 4 people. Pick any of these people and watch them, Donna Adelson, and watch her. And then you're going to see that the soup of chaos that was going on chemically with her might have been the cause and not premeditation. People that act like that in a courtroom, she is a deviation from the norm of absolutely every single guilty person that was premeditated in doing a heinous thing against three kids or any other human being, let alone three kids. And I know it's horrendous to watch. This is the most horrendous thing I've ever seen in my entire life. It is so emotionally draining to watch. But if you can stomach it, I challenge you to do it. Keep an open mind and just keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm. Siobhan, what do you say to the, the prosecution is saying, well, look at this bag of prescriptions. Do you know how many she didn't take? And it looks like there were some she was taking as directed. There were some she was not taking as directed. So you have someone who already is coming in with a broken brain. There's a problem going on here. And then we're like, she's not following instructions. Yeah, that kind of comes along with the territory of someone who's already going through this sort of thing. What's your response to that from a psychological standpoint of, number one, getting people to take their meds, which can be a headache in itself, or to put it lightly, but more so someone who's in this state, she's being taken from this drug to that drug, some are working, some are not working, some take time to work, and then getting off of others, you're dealing with the withdrawals, I'm sure, of yeah. some of these while being on them, other ones. I mean, what's your response to the simplicity of the prosecution going, well, she didn't take all of her medicine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's simplicity is the right word, and ignorance. You know, if yeah. somebody starts a medication and they feel worse, they tend to say, okay, I took it for a week. I took 7 days of Zoloft. I'm feeling worse. Mm-hmm. She also had anxiety around breastfeeding, which I've seen with many mothers who have postpartum depression. They're prescribed an antidepressant. Sometimes they take it, but then they get frightened. Is this going to harm the baby? And they stop. And the other piece is, if you're having psychosis, which she clearly was, you're not thinking real clearly. And yeah. you're not able to make the kind of educated decision that you would make if you were in your right mind. And she wasn't in her right mind. And then having to change providers for reasons that made perfect sense. You know, when people are seeing one provider, they're getting worse, they're getting worse, they're getting worse. The medication they're giving isn't helping. They look for a different provider. We tell people to do that. You know, if you feel like you're not being listened to, it's not getting better, you need to see somebody else. So I don't see anything that confuses me with that.
How often, I mean, obviously this is kind of more of an extreme case where you have the children that have died, but we see cases every single day of women who end their own lives themselves, and not necessarily the lives of their children, as they're going through the hell of postpartum depression, or in rarer cases, postpartum psychosis. We don't hear their full stories. We don't hear it litigated in a courtroom. We don't hear it on national coverage. We don't talk because we're unaware of it. But from a clinical standpoint, from behind the scenes, behind the curtain, how often, in your opinion, are women being failed by the medical system and the mental health system every single day, where it ends in tragedy? Maybe not where the three kids die, but where the mom doesn't make it through because of the lack of oversight, the whatever the hell went wrong here. And there seems to be a cornucopia of things that went wrong in this case. Is this an odd one off to the side, or are more women in our country experiencing this sort of cattle call, if you will, through the system and being treated exactly like that and not like a human being that needs intimate attention, deep attention to their mental health, and not just here's some pills, move on. I have another telehealth appointment to get to in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very much a problem. I talk to women all the time going through menopause, having postpartum concerns, that they just don't feel that they're taken seriously, that they're not listened to. And part of this is systemic, that people, providers don't have enough time. You know, are they getting a 10 or 15 minute telehealth visit? Nobody is really going deep enough into what they're experiencing. They're isolated often. They don't have enough support. And I do think that it's more of a female problem. I think we've got quite a bit of research about that, which is why most research studies, medical research studies, are done on men. They haven't traditionally been done on women. And women have a different neurohormonal system. And I think we need to do a lot better with that.
That's horrifying. Just that fact is horrifying, that they're more done on men than women.
Yes.
And it's 2026, and I feel like that should be like something that we're realizing in like 1964. Like, maybe we should do more of a balance instead of 2026. Like, really? Really? God. Mm-hmm. Robin?
No, I'm sorry. I was responding on the text strings. Because basically, I know it's such a big case for everyone involved, because there's a lot of emotions running behind it. So I was just trying to keep to the facts and helping people with the facts of understanding they're claiming responsibility for her killing her kids. That's not at issue here. The actual statute that they're putting forward, her and her lawyer putting forward, is that it's pursuing a lack of criminal responsibility defense. That's what they're trying to do. If they're successful at that, sentencing would entail, most likely, it really depends on the periodic evaluations, but a life behind bars.
Yeah.
And so it's just what kind of life behind bars that is. Is she going to be put in with, if she's found guilty of premeditation, killing of her kids, then it's going to be a life behind bars without that, where she's going to be in general population as you know, paralyzed individual from the waist down, as opposed to a life behind bars as someone paralyzed from the waist down and getting a therapeutic treatment for her condition. So it's still a life behind bars.
Yes.
And so it's just the argument here that prosecution is making is premeditation, that she was in her right mind and was completely witting of what she was doing, and defense is saying she wasn't because of this. And so it's still, so everyone, I know people are getting wrapped, she's not getting away on anything forever, because she says, I did it. And so what we are just talking about is what caused the I did it.
Yeah, and a locked forensic mental health facility. I used to be, one of my jobs, the person that goes in and evaluates who's ready to get out and who's not. And most of the time, they never got out. And these are not, it's not Club Med, right? It is basically just a prison where more treatment is provided.
Thank you so much for your context on that. And of course, you've been there and done that.
Understanding this is not excusing this. And I think that's the biggest thing that people wrestle with. They think that if I understand this, I'm excusing it. No, if you understand this, you're doing more help so we can help more people not be in this situation in the future. The more we pretend that this is some sort of witchery that's going on and that you should be burned at the stake, does nothing for understanding mental health and helping people in the future. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and for you to give us your thoughts. We'll continue our conversation there. And of course, we'll continue to cover it as this trial continues on. Siobhan's book, Nightbird, I highly suggest you go get this. It's available wherever you get books or audiobooks. Go and check it out. And Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available also wherever you get books and audiobooks. Go check it out. Leave a review on Amazon. Also greatly appreciated. All right, that's going to wrap up today's episode. Thank you guys so much. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, for Siobhan, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Ahora en McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken meal deal o un $6 McDouble meal deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.